Hello, and thanks for listening. I have a question for you. Have you done your good deed for the day? Well, if not, I'm going to help you. All you have to do to feel great about yourself today is tell a friend or 200 about this show and tell them to sign up for our newsletter so they can keep updated on all things Moonbird. The link is simple. It's memoriesofamoonbird.com/newsletter. For your convenience, it's also in the show notes. So go ahead, text it to everybody right now. Don't let me stop you. I mean, everybody. Everybody in your contacts. I'll wait. This might take a while. All right, hit pause and come back when you're done. memoriesofamoonbird.com/newsletter. Welcome to the Memories of a Moonbird podcast, exploring life one story at a time. Hello friends, I'm Daniel Sherrill. Today on the show, he's a fascinating human being and an award-winning environmentalist. He's the director of government relations and public policy for Scenic Hudson, the New York-based organization credited with launching the modern grassroots environmental movement. There, he oversees the organization's engagement with local, state, and federal government officials and directs grassroots and legislative lobbying campaigns. He's the recipient of the Land Trust Alliance's National Ambassadors Award for Advocacy, has successfully helped the passage of legislation critical to the Hudson Valley's way of life, and helped raise billions of dollars in federal, state, and local funding for the environment. In his spare time, he's also an avid cyclist, bicycle mechanic, camper, and musician who dabbles in blacksmithing and gardening. But this champion for the earth and father of two great kids is not battling just the environment. In 2015, his wife Jenny was diagnosed with breast cancer, and as a family, their journey through treatment and management continues to this day. Here to talk about those struggles and life lessons, the environment, and so much more, please welcome Mr. Andy Bicking. Andy, welcome to the show.
Daniel, I'm so grateful to be here today. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's start off with, where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Wilmington, Delaware, where I spent about the first 10 years of my life before my parents uprooted and moved to northeastern Ohio.
What was little Andy like as a child?
I guess when I think back, I was quiet, I was observant, but also, you know, I liked to read, I liked quiet time, but I also really was interested in getting outside, exploring the neighborhood, nearby parks, seeing what was happening around me. I liked structure a lot, did really well in programs like the Scouts, but at the same time, loved and cherished my free time just to be who I wanted to be.
Yeah. And you grew up like I did in an era when there was no internet, there was no cell phones. So you had a lot of time to just be with yourself out in the world.
So true. So true.
What's a brief story that your parents would tell about you as a child?
Oh, man. I'd like to think that they would tell good stories. They might also tell stories about a few times I would get in trouble. It seems like those are the ones that come out at family gatherings the most.
Let's hear one of those.
You know, like the time in high school when I skipped school and my dad threatened to turn me in or have myself turn myself in. And so I went, marched into the assistant principal's office, said, "I'm turning myself in for skipping school." And the guy looked at me straight in the face. He said, "You're what?" And I said, "That's right. You busted my friends and it's not fair that you got just them. So you have to, throw me in the slammer too." Yeah, that's a funny one that stands out for sure.
Wait, what happened? Did you get detention?
Well, yeah. And I was one of those kids that did pretty well academically. I always stayed out of trouble. And this was just like senior skip day. We went up to Lake Erie on the beach with a couple friends. And I was friends with all kinds of people. Like, I didn't really have to run with people who just got good grades or were from the right neighborhood. I just liked them because they were people. And so some people I ran with, you know, were getting in trouble a lot more frequently. And I just didn't think it was fair that, you know, they would get busted for something and that it would be overlooked, for me breaking the rules. So it seemed like a good out to go turn myself in.
Well, how old were you when you moved from Delaware to Ohio?
I was 10 and a half.
So what did you want to be when you were a kid growing up in Delaware?
Well, Delaware, you know, when I was a young boy, I had a poster on my wall. It was like from the 1960s or something. It was some of the early space exploration, the satellites, the rocket ships. And I just really, really wanted to be an astronaut. I think that would have been the coolest job ever. But I also, you know, loved history and, you know, this idea of like being an archaeologist and digging up treasures would have been really cool. My grandparents traveled all over the world, so they were always coming back with these stories about places they had been. And that seemed to be like a fun career. And then the other big one was a park ranger. You know, I think it was just attracted to Smokey Bear and, you know, those big hats just seemed like it would have been a pretty cool job to have.
Well, tell me, what's something about you that's still distinctly Ohio or Delaware that you carry with you today?
I guess spending my teenage years in Ohio in a relatively conservative town, but having a relatively liberal family, I really learned the value of just tolerance and trying to look past political differences and really uphold community. And at the same time, hold a strong line about the things that were important to me, you know, that everyone should be treated fairly and equally. And there was certainly a lot of, you know, racism and a lot of bias about, you know, income and stuff growing up in the community around me. And I did not like that at all, but at a more basic level, you know, to understanding that despite differences we might have with people, neighbors are still neighbors and you got to look out for each other and you have something in common and you're pushing for the common good.
Well, speaking of the common good, let's talk about the common good of the planet Earth. When did you actually become interested in working as an environmentalist?
Well, yeah, it's always was interested in the environment from the age of being very, very young. And my dad was involved in parks and recreation management for government for most of his career.
Wait, which character in Parks and Rec would he be? Oh,
like? Yeah. Not Ron Swanson, kind of the antithesis of Ron Swanson. But we spent a lot of time going out to parks. I spent a lot of time camping with my parents as a kid and really valued that time outdoors. But I never really conceived of being able to work on behalf of the environment. The notion of not-for-profits just never occurred to me growing up. And it wasn't until my late 20s when I moved to New York and found out about the organization that I work for now, where it really opened my eyes and seemed like a real career opportunity.
I'm curious, which aspect of environmental degradation do you specifically focus on?
Well, Scenic Hudson is kind of interesting as an organization. They are both a land trust, so we protect land and we make parks. And at the same time, we're an advocacy organization. And having two of those kind of core skill sets under the same roof is really, really amazing. And it lets us have a huge, broad platform to work on a whole set of different issues. But for the most part, the issues I'm most engaged on relate to land use, habitat loss, the loss of public access to the Hudson River and traditional uses of the waterfront. But I'm also very involved in legacy contaminants and trying to find ways to work with federal and state government to get them cleaned up.
That's amazing. And before I get specific with some of the career stuff, I want to back up a step and ask you, and I'm not sure if you know this or not, but the history of that particular area of the country is Native American, correct? Going way back?
That's right. The area where I live in the Mid-Hudson Valley was kind of an interface of two major indigenous groups, the Lenape to the south and the Mohican to the north. And actually, the community that I am is called Esopus, which was named after the kind of subgroup that lived in this area. But there were influences from both of those cultural systems.
And so is there any kind of indigenous influence there today? Have those cultures survived in the area?
Yeah, I think like a lot of places around the country, unfortunately, a lot of the indigenous cultures have really been devastated by the American settlement and the capitalist system. But there are still communities live in the Hudson Valley that are directly descended from the original inhabitants. And that's really exciting. And you know, one recent example of that, you know, through the pandemic, my wife and I have actually been taking lessons in the Lenape language that's cool. being offered through a local historic site in coordination with the Lenape Muncie group, which is based up in Canada right now, but still has a lot of deep ties and connections to the Hudson Valley.
That's fantastic. Well, let's talk about environmental work a little bit. What problems do you encounter most as an environmentalist?
Well, one of the big things we're dealing with, which is ubiquitous around the globe, is climate change. And you know, the climate is changing. It is going to continue to change. It is, I don't want to be a pessimist, but it's probably impossible to go back to the way things were.
Yeah, you often hear that we're going to have to just create a new normal.
Yeah, we have to create a new normal. We have to find ways to adapt. And working on climate issues is some of the most exciting stuff because the science is really cutting edge. You know, whether that's figuring out how to help communities prepare for sea level rise and flooding. You know, the Hudson River is tidally influenced. We have a 4-foot tide just about a mile away from my house. So a lot of these local places have to figure out what to do.
So soon you're going to have beachfront property.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Not quite, but almost. But that's a big land use issue we've got to grapple with. But there's also big opportunities in figuring out how we can use forests and agricultural land to capture carbon, through this thing called what we call sequestration, literally managing our natural spaces to not just grow food, but try to capture some of the most harmful greenhouse gases and store them in our soil.
Why store them in the soil? That's interesting.
Well, if you think about it, carbon dioxide, just for example, is toxic for people, right? It's one of the major causes of global warming, but it's also food for plants. And that gets fixated in the roots and kind of stored in the soil in conjunction with an interesting relationship between the plant roots and various funguses that grow underground.
Wow.
And you can actually draw a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it there, as well as nitrogen dioxide and other compounds as well.
Wow, that's fantastic. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I'm curious, have you observed any kind of specific habits from people that are responsible for degradation of the environment?
Huh. I think at its core, there is a selfishness and a short-sightedness that happens. And people who willfully destroy the environment aren't always thinking about how they relate to other people and other species. And they're not the kind of people who acknowledge systems and think dynamically about the place that we play in the greater whole. And so I think that's probably the biggest factor. And there are people who probably do that intentionally. And there are people who probably do that just because they don't know any better.
Yeah. How do you reach both?
Well, I guess they're different audiences, but I've always been attracted to this idea that I call gateway environmentalism, right? And if you think about an experience that we may all have had as a kid or something we might have with our families where we have a really nice time outside. Like, and maybe it's something as simple as like you're doing a riverfront cleanup and you're picking up trash, or it's just a beautiful walk in the park. And if we can just get people to stop and reflect on that a little bit more and understand, that those moments don't just happen, right? I mean, they happen, but they're there for a reason, and they're there because of the environment. And if we can open up a little space around that conversation, it becomes a lot easier to have serious talks about the behavior that we all have and what we can do to be better citizens of the planet.
Have you heard of permaculture?
I have.
So I had Warren Brush on the show, who's a famous permaculturist.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, he was great. And I think that doing everything you're saying and also sciences like permaculture and putting those systems into place is really the key to a successful future.
Yes, so permaculture is really fascinating. And there is a deep connection to this idea of carbon sequestration as well. And I think it all stems from the point of, if we're being a little bit more mindful about how we're managing natural lands, we can achieve a lot of co-benefits, whether that is clean water or whether that is energy efficiency or whether that's carbon sequestration or whether that's growing food more productively.
It's funny you mentioned that only because one of the things I've learned in the last couple of years was that as a nation and as a world, we're actually growing a lot of our food in the wrong places. So like, for instance, almonds maybe would do better in a certain country or a certain environment, and we're not growing them there. Instead, we're growing them maybe in California or wherever. And I'm shooting spit here at the actual item. I don't know which items go where, but there are scientists who are saying that if we would actually start growing these foods in the locations where they're most optimal, then it would reduce the amount of water they take. It's better for the environment, and it would do wonders for the planet. So I'm just like, why are we not doing this?
Yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And you know, some of the great wisdom in agriculture, for example, exists in you know, you look at cultures that are still doing things in the traditional way. And they did that for a reason, right? And we can still learn a lot about through modern technology, but starting from the place of seeing what has worked for thousands of years before us is not a bad place to start at all.
History is a great educator. Yes. Well, how do you and Scenic Hudson spread awareness amongst people?
Well, I'm very lucky to work with a lot of super smart and talented and caring people. And we communicate to a lot of different audiences. You know, I think first and foremost, the people who live, work, and play in the Hudson Valley are the people who we aim to serve. And we engage them in school programs. We engage them in kind of community outreach. We engage them through our advocacy. But yeah, you know, at its core, I think it's about meeting people where they are and trying to find common ground. And starting from the place of what's the intersection between environmental goals and community goals. And if we can find that sweet spot, you get really sustainable outcomes and add in a little intersection with the economic benefits as well. And it becomes even more popular. So
yeah, I mean, money talks, obviously. So
So I'm a firm believer in trying to, you know, compromise not under principles, but maybe on the ideas that we have, and not make any assumptions going into a situation, and really trying to find that common ground with people.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you specifically to that note is, have you noticed in your time doing this a positive response since you were a kid till today? Do you think that environmental awareness and the people in general, has it gotten better in your opinion?
I think it's gotten better and worse at the same time, to be completely honest. Like,
just explain.
Think about a global issue. Like when we were kids, you heard about the ozone hole, right? And a bunch of nations got together. They met with industry. They came up with a voluntary program, and the ozone hole started to shrink. And that was really amazing. We dealt proactively with the problem. With climate change, we haven't been able to pull that off yet. You know, at the same time, we've had huge success in creating new programs, whether they're regulatory or voluntary, to clean up pollution. But we've also created new kinds of pollution. You look at the prevalence of plastic and how much of our containers have shifted towards away from glass and cardboard. When we were kids and are now lightweight plastics, those break down and they become toxins in the environment, and we don't have a way of addressing them yet.
Do you think we will?
I'm optimistic that we will. You know, if I had my way, there would be a balance between new technology to address the problems and just being smarter about not putting bad stuff into the environment in the first place.
So when you have people in the world, because I'm going to play devil's advocate here, who say, man, this whole climate change thing is so overblown and it's not as bad as they think, and the earth is going to take care of itself. It's a giant filter. It's not going to let human beings ruin it, blah, 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 blah. What do you say to those people?
Well, I say, you know, look at the data, look at the science. And most scientists agree that we have a problem. And that the trend line shows that the climate is changing. And if you look around the world to places where it's changed more quickly than others, you begin to see, you know, major impacts of that, whether it's loss of cropland, whether it's drought, whether it's more severe and more frequent storms or flooding, heat waves, you name it. And those are real effects. And I think at its core, people respond to what they see and what they experience. So even if they don't want to engage the science, even if they have an issue with the political rhetoric around the climate, if you just stop and really think about what's changed in our lifetimes, you will see change in the world. And if we can start focusing on those issues and those impacts, we'll deal with climate change as well as other issues our communities are facing.
I'm curious, when we're kids, and we're doing something, we're misbehaving as children, and a parent comes in and says, listen, if you don't knock it off, you're going to be grounded. and then you continue to misbehave and your toy gets taken away or whatever it is, and you get grounded, you get punished, right? Is there a part of you that believes that humanity is just going to be punished by the environment, that at some point we will have messed up so badly or not paid attention to things or not tried hard enough to fix things that the earth is going to respond and a lot of us are going to die? And it's going to be like, well, what did you expect? We warned you this was coming and you did nothing about it.
Well, I am an optimist and I've got a lot of hope. And I look around to some of the things that have happened here in the Hudson Valley and changed in the short 23 years I've been working here. And when I was moving to New York, I was actually a bicycle messenger at the time, which is the greatest job ever. And it was a bicycle messenger in Columbus, Ohio. And
wait, quick sidebar. Why is that the greatest job ever?
I got to ride my bike and eat as many bagels as I wanted. I mean, come on. It's like, it was awesome. but I was actually in the county courthouse in Columbus, Ohio. And there was a judge I'd gotten to know because I was always delivering to their chamber. And they kind of struck up a friendship. And I told them where I was moving. And they said, you know, when you move there, you're going to see all of the problems that our country faces with the environment, but you're also going to see all of the solutions. And that has been true since I've been living here. And The mere fact that citizens got together and they fought a major pump storage hydroelectric facility that was on the face of a beautiful mountain in the Hudson Highlands called Storm King Mountain. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in that decision, they not only stopped the power plant from moving forward and getting developed, but also guaranteed the fundamental right of legal standing for people to intervene in land use decisions and actually have their voice matter on issues that previously they did not have any legal right to be heard, as a huge step forward. And that culture of people feeling like they can engage in our democracy to guide these decisions that we are all making as a society holds true to this day. And that value is there. And I do believe in the collective wisdom of people. And the media, you hear a lot of bad news. There's a lot of negativity out there. It's really easy to get stuck in that trap. But if you start looking at what the hundreds and the thousands of the community-based organizations and the nonprofit community is delivering in our country and this world, it is amazing. And it really is a good reason for hope. And if we focus on those stories, we focus on those as models, we can do a lot, we can learn from them, and we can take those lessons and apply them elsewhere.
Well, I actually, like you, I'm also an optimist, and I have to ask these questions because I want to address the other side, but I am not only 100% in agreement with you, but I've also seen a lot of these people today who, like friends of mine who have young kids, and these kids are growing up in a world so aware of the earth and of politics and of their role in the giant machinery of awe, you know? And I think it's really inspiring that they do seem to really care, and they, you know, they want freedom of gender and they want freedom of expression and they just want people to love each other. And it's really a beautiful thing to see how the youth is so empowered.
It is so true. And I mean, no matter what one may think, you look at the power of the Black Lives Matter movement, you look at the power of the movement about gender equality, you look at the power of the Me Too movement, and at its core, these are people standing up and they're saying, I matter, the people around me matter, you need to listen to us, you need to treat us fairly. And that's a beautiful thing. And those things are so important. It extends to the environment as well. And as a core value, human rights and environmental rights are the same thing.
Well said. I'm curious, what non-government organizations and social groups do you guys work with?
Well, Scenic Hudson works with a really wide cross-section of groups. And that's what I love about it. We'll work with everyone from a local environmental club, or a local community garden or a local fish and game club, all the way up to, working collaboratively with the echelons of power in Washington, D.C. And from the big global nonprofits like the Nature Conservancy down to the local African American Cultural Association, Harambe in Kingston, we're finding ways to work with all of them. And I absolutely love that because it lets us touch so many people's lives and gives a huge opportunity to try to make things just a little bit better.
That's awesome. Well, as someone who works extensively with the government, I'm curious, do you think that our government is doing enough to give importance to the environmental issues?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I get asked that question a lot, and there's no simple answer to that. And being in government relations, I'll be the first to tell you that there's not just one government. And there's a lot of jurisdictions that are out there. You know, we have federal government, we have state, you have local, you've got in some cases, you know, regional entities and special authorities, and each one has a different purpose. And so I don't like generalizing and saying government is one thing or another. And at its core, government are people. And, you know, people can care about things, they can make good decisions, they can make bad decisions. From that perspective, the answer is mixed. You know, sometimes we see things come out from government that are on balance bad for the environment, but sometimes we see great things happen. Yeah, at the moment, I'm very optimistic with the broader public awareness around issues like climate. And some of the attention that's playing in states around the country and in Washington, D.C., that we can begin to see some meaningful solutions put in place. You know, will it be everything we need? Probably not. But I'm an incrementalist, and I think we need to take things step by step.
Yeah,
keep
agreed.
Building on the successes of the past.
So what are your future plans? And for Sina Cudson, what do you guys have coming down the road?
Well, I'm really excited. We are getting ready to open a new park in Hudson River waterfront in a city that's about 25,000 in population. And the community does not have any kind of public park of this size. It's going to be 500 acres. It's going to be a collaboration with New York State. It will eventually become a new state park. And that's just exciting to think about establishing a 500 acre reserve within walking distance of, you know, like 25,000 people.
So wait, so you are the Leslie of Parks and Rec.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. There's any number of issues that we're working on as well. I'm excited. The federal transportation bill is kind of under negotiation as we speak. There's a big opportunity there to get public funding in place for water treatment facilities to make sure we're not dumping our waste into our waterways, but also to be investing in trails and bicycle and pedestrian amenities to make our streets safer and more comfortable places to be.
You mentioned technology earlier. How much of a role does technology play in saving our planet versus human interaction, in your opinion?
Of course, technology is going to have a role to play, and it already has. It has for our entire history. From the moment someone put a shovel in the ground, there was technology at play. But it's how we choose to use the tools that we have that I think is the most important thing, and making sure that we're using them in a smart way and that we're selecting the best tool for the problems that we have.
Well, Andy, in one statement, if you could, what message do you have personally for the coming generation?
Good question.
Besides, be excellent to each other.
What would Bill and Ted do? I would say check your facts, understand systems, be strategic and don't give up. And when things feel like they're the hardest, it's actually when you're getting closer to the solution.
I'm curious, what are your least and most favorite parts of your job?
I hate the commute. that 30 to 45 minute car ride is just no fun. You know, it's like I'd rather be home or just getting things done. The thing I love about my job the most is even on a hard day, like I can drive home after a hard day from work and I'll pass a park or a conserved landscape or something as simple as a culvert under the road that lets endangered species kind of cross underneath of it safely. And I can look at it and I can say, yeah, I was part of that. And whatever caused my really bad day today, this was still worth it. And working at a regional level, I do get to see the results of the work I do and of my colleagues on a daily basis. And I'm constantly reminded of it. And I see people out enjoying those very same places. And so I draw a huge amount of inspiration from that.
That's really cool. I'm curious, have you ever considered quitting? And if yes, what kept you going?
You know, I've never considered quitting.
That's great.
I've had good days. I've had bad days. I've had good months and bad months. But I think what keeps me going is just this idea that if we stop and we give up, then you know the forces that are out there that are harmful to the world are going to win.
Yeah, that's that famous quote, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing, which I'm going to adapt and say the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing.
That's exactly right. That's the long and the short of it. I love that quote. That's perfect.
Andy, what's something about your career that most people don't know that you wish they did?
As a lobbyist, the thing that is most hard to explain to other people, like a lot of people have this image in their mind of a lobbyist and they see it on TV or, you know, kind of make-believe shows. But yeah, at its core, it's about relationships and it's about finding common grounds. And we, despite all the things you may hear on the news, at its core, we live in a society that values democratic participation. And if you show up and you've got your facts straight and you present kind of a reasonable argument, in my experience, most elected officials are excited and interested in to engage in those kinds of discussions. It doesn't mean that they always agree, you know, nor should they be expected to always agree. And you know, while we hope they do, on balance, at the end of the day, I've seen the sum of all of those conversations, you know, amount in some really good, well-balanced decisions that are made. So, you know, I want to let everyone know that from someone who spends a lot of time kind of on the inside, observing and advocating with government, yes, there is dysfunction. You hear about all this, but there's also an awful lot of good people, more good people than bad, who care deeply about their work and are making things happen every day so you can continue to do the things that you love doing.
That's actually really wonderful to hear, especially after the last 4 years and the storming of the Capitol and everything we've endured as a country. It's really nice to hear you say that.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer in civic society, and we need to participate in that system. And it's a fragile system, believe me. And I think we've seen how fragile it can be over the past year in particular. But if we show up, we put ourselves out there in a genuine way, we participate, we pay attention to meetings, that will affect, will make things better.
What is the most valuable insight that you think you've learned from your career so far?
You know, the most valuable thing is I've learned is just to not make assumptions about other people and to really try to start from a place of collaboration with them and start from a place of trying to understand their point of view. And, you know, I found if you can do that, you can get pretty far with people. And, you know, it's in the advocacy community, there's a lot of people, particularly young people. And I was like this to some extent. You come in, you've got an idea in your head, you've got a mission, you feel like you need to do something, you feel a strong sense of urgency. And all of that represents a lot of power and energy, but you've got to apply it in the right direction. And you don't want to burn out. So kind of funneling that into productive relationships that you can create over the long term with people can really be a great key to getting things done.
Have you ever felt like you have this whole thing figured out, life, career, family?
Why would I want to figure that out? No, I'm serious. Like, well, the purpose is not to figure it out. The purpose is to explore it and experience it. And yeah, are there things we learn along the way? But we're always presented with new things that happen in our life. You know, there is no perfect in this life we get to live.
I'm very curious, if you weren't an environmentalist, what would you be?
I think I would be a hermit or a bicycle mechanic.
Or both.
Or a donut taster.
Ooh. Couldn't you do all those at the same time? A guy who lives by himself in a cave, works on bikes, and eats donuts?
No, in all seriousness, I think I've done this as a volunteer, and I absolutely love it. But I would love to open up a community bicycle workshop and just make bicycles available to people who need them, teach them how to fix them, how to maintain them, teach them how to ride on them safely and enjoy them. I just think they're a wonderful piece of technology that can open up a realm of experiences to people. It can help you get places faster and see the world in a different way. And I get a lot of joy out of them. I get a lot of joy out of sharing them with other people. And I think if I could do anything, I would do more of that.
And I think that you should make that your retirement dream.
Excellent. I'm working on it.
Well, Andy, in 2015, your wife was diagnosed with stage one invasive ductal carcinoma. And for other people out there who may be dealing with breast cancer and other forms of cancer or their own struggles with other diseases, we're going to talk about your experience. And before we do, though, I wanted to thank you and Jenny and your kids for their bravery and for being willing to share your story and talk about this publicly, because it's a big deal. The first question I'd like to ask you is, what happened when you first got the news?
Well, my wife was diagnosed after her first mammogram when she turned 40. And she had it. We went on vacation and we just had this sense that there was not going to be great news. You know, it was just like the sixth sense that we had for some reason. And the call came in and, you know, there was, we were actually on vacation. The call said, you know, we need you to kind of come back. And at that moment, it was this, they didn't say it, but we just knew that something was not right. And I remember sitting around, we were actually camping and sitting around the campfire and just looking at each other and kind of acknowledging that this was going to be big. It was going to be life-changing. And it's something that we had to take one step at a time, right? You could have let ourselves kind of run down a certain, you know, track a certain line of thinking and kind of think about it in certain ways. But we knew that if we did that, it would not be helpful. And we just needed to take it one step at a time based on the facts.
And it's been a little over 5 years now. What's the journey been like so far?
Man, it has just been a roller coaster. You know, there are good days and there are bad days. The first 9 months or so were really intense. There were three surgeries. There was several months of chemotherapy every couple of weeks. There was a month solid of radiation and a lot of healing and recovery after that. And then pills every single day that affected her mood and affected her energy levels, but fortunately worked to keep the cancer at bay for several years until just a little over a year ago. She was re-diagnosed, had a recurrence, and we learned that the cancer had metastasized and actually had moved into her bones.
Wait, can you explain what metastasize means for the listeners?
Metastasis is when the cancer leaves the original area and actually populates another spot of the body. So she had it in her soft tissues, and then it was later found in her bone and in possibly her liver. So it's literally migrated from one place of the body to another.
So you got this new diagnosis. How has that changed the path of her therapy and what's happening in her life?
Yeah, it has changed it significantly. She has to get a whole different type of medication. And the way cancer treatment works, at least in our kind of cancer that she is dealing with, you can move through levels of therapy. And when you use up one therapeutic course or one treatment and it stops working, you have to move on to another. And you can't go back and use the one that you had previously used. So we're on a kind of course number two right now, if you will, and we're trying out a different set of treatments that involve some, you know, very painful shots that she needs to receive about every 4 weeks that really reduce her energy and knock her out for, you know, a week or so and make it very painful for her to move around. So that's really affected our family life, you know, quite a bit. From the time when she was post-surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation treatment, and just on medication that was affecting her energy, but she was still kind of the same mom, the same wife over the course of every day, to now where we've got a lot of ups and downs, you know, kind of following the monthly treatment schedule, where she'll feel really bad for, you know, a week or week and a half, then start to get better for another week and a half. And then the fatigue sets in. We kind of deal with that for a week and then slowly getting back to normal before we go in for the shots again.
Are there an infinite number of treatment paths you can take, or are they finite? Well, at some point down the road, will you guys not have an option?
Yeah. And that happens to a lot of people in cancer treatment. At some point, there are just are no more therapies or no more treatments that they can take. And that's a sad day. So yeah, the strategy is to try to kind of do every spread out the effectiveness of any one treatment. And, you know, you hope that it works for a long time. You know, you hope that it works for 20 years. And for some people, it does. You know, for some people, it works only for a matter of months. And, you know, that's a feeling that we deal with. And I think I deal with and my kids deal with a lot is this sense of like, when's the other shoe going to drop? Like it dropped once, like we got this diagnosis and things got a little better. And then another shoe dropped and things got worse again. And now we're kind of in another holding pattern. And, you know, we're all painfully aware that at some point things are going to change again. It is a treatable, but not a curable disease.
Being an optimist, are you hopeful that at some point down the road, they will find a cure?
Well, you know, optimism can mean a lot of things. And maybe I should have gotten to this more when we were having the discussion about my work on the environment. But yeah, optimism doesn't always mean that things are going to get better to me. You know, what it means, what happiness means, is that you're kind of engaging with the situations that are around you and that you are able to continue to be a whole person and find meaning and purpose in your life. And if we can do that, there's a lot to be optimistic about and a lot to look forward to. So in that respect, like I am an optimist, like I'm an optimist that our relationships will deepen. I'm an optimist that this experience will continue to connect us to the cancer community, which has some amazing people in it. But at its core, she has a specific kind of cancer that cannot be cured. And you know, that's something that needs to be accepted, you know, kind of ignoring that fact is not a healthy or a happy position to find oneself in.
Now, as a family, you've had to have discussions with your children that most parents never do. And I'm just curious, how has that affected them as children? How has it affected you as a parent? And is there anything you've gleaned from that that you would like to express to the community at large?
Yeah, it is so hard. And you know, every parent out there or anyone who's just been a kid and had a parent, you know, knows that family relations are at times not easy, right? But especially when you think about, I tend to think about this experience like in a human development model. And, you know, in a normal life, you wouldn't really have to confront mortality of a parent or someone or a spouse until a certain point, till a certain age. And, you know, unfortunately, my kids got dealt with this when they were 9 and 13, right? And developmentally, they just didn't have the tools that most adults have to be able to deal with this. And that is a really hard situation to parent through, like not just explaining what's happening, like everyone gets the facts, but to give a 9-year-old or a 13-year-old the perspective and the emotional toolkit they need to navigate something like this is just a constant challenge. But yeah, at its core, you know, what I've really learned is just the value of openness and honest communication. And that hiding things is not in anyone's interest. And, you know, just trying to take these issues that we experience head on and trying to be compassionate and friendly with each other and loving towards each other is the important goal. And, you know, also where we can continue to find a lot of meaning.
Well, and you hope that having been exposed to such things so young, that it will actually turn around and be a positive thing, that as they grow into adults, well, they are young adults now, but as they grow into very much adulthood, have relationships of their own, and they go out in the world, that they take with them this perspective of the value of every day and time and love and what is actually really important in the world, and that they themselves become the progenitors of that kind of thought process for the world and bring that awareness to the world.
Yeah, I would certainly hope so. And you know, wouldn't that be an amazing thing after several generations of humanity could find a way to, you know, share some of these lessons with itself, you know, more ubiquitously? Yeah. That would be an amazing thing.
Do you live with the knowledge that your wife could die at any time, or is she going to be okay as long as she continues treatment?
Well, yeah, I do live with that. I mean, the question is a little bit hyperbolic, right? Anytime is like, yeah, no, not anytime. Like we would have,
well, I mean, and you could bite it in the car and the way it works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, exactly. But yeah, at some point we do know that this is what's going to get her. And, you know, statistically it will probably, you know, get her before my time comes or my kid's time comes, you know, you never know. But that's a hard thing to live with. And kind of one of the first lessons I learned on this is just really getting comfortable with our own mortality. Like, I was in my mid 40s and feeling great. And she had just turned 40 when this happened. And, we didn't have any health issues at all. And then all of a sudden you're confronted with, kind of a mortal illness. It's, pretty heavy. And just getting kind of comfortable living with that is, been a lesson. And, you know, people always joke about it. You could walk out in the street and, you know, a piano could fall on your head. That could happen to anyone. It's unlikely to happen, but it could. The experience of being a caregiver for someone with cancer has just kind of reminded me about the frailty of life and that each of us every single day are really, you know, walking on a really narrow edge. And we have so much to be grateful for.
Well, your positivity during all this is really inspiring and really incredible. I also wanted to just take a moment to say, as someone who, you know, watched my father die of cancer, that the people that go through the disease certainly have, without question, the hardest part of this journey, of course. But it takes its toll on the caretakers as well. And so to all the caretakers out there who are listening, who may be taking care of someone who's got a disease or some kind of condition, I just want you to know that you're not alone, that there's people out there that understand, there's community outreach, and don't ever be afraid to ask for help. It's really important. Andy, I know that your community has really reached out and helped you guys through this whole process. And I was wondering if there's anything you'd like to say to those people.
Yeah, boy, I would just say thank you to so many people. And yeah, it's interesting when our family's confronted with this, we realized we had friends where we didn't know we had friends. And there were people, even who were not friends with, who just started showing up and offering to help in small ways. And that is just such a nice thing to know that there are people out there who are care and are watching and doing things to support us. And, you know, the single biggest thing that I just find like in our home economy is because of the division of labor between my wife and I, it has been really helpful, like during the toughest days of her treatment, to have a friend deliver a meal, you know, just to have a home cooked dinner is such a huge relief because it lets me be able to focus on caring for her and supporting my kids in the way that they need to be supported and keeping the home moving forward, as yeah. well as just giving a little bit of time for myself to, you know, process the experience and try to get in a good emotional space and not be ruled by the stress that it brings.
How has the whole cancer affected your marriage? Are you guys closer now? And is it easier for you guys to just let the small stuff go?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, it sounds kind of cliche, but it's true. Like suddenly there's bigger issues that we have to tend to on a daily basis. And yeah, like in any relationship, you bring your own baggage to it, right? And it kind of puts a spotlight on that in a really ridiculous way when you're kind of having an argument about something and then you cool off a little bit. And you're like, man, not only was that a stupid argument, but it was like doubly stupid because my wife has cancer. God, I'm a dork.
Yeah.
So you do get that perspective and it is under a microscope and you're kind of forced to look at it if you want to move forward and enjoy your life. So yeah, in a weird way, that's even been a blessing.
Is there any last thing you'd like to say to people about this subject?
You know, I think there is, and this is a pet peeve. And, you know, one of the things often when I tell people my wife has cancer is they immediately kind of go into this position of like shock and remorse and like, oh, I'm so sorry. And like, I get that. Like, I understand how that's someone's first reaction to hearing about bad news in someone else's life. You know, my own experience, what people need most who are suffering is not that kind of response. but they need a different kind of question to come back, which is really simple, which is like, is there anything you'd like to share with me about that experience? Or what kind of things do you find helpful on your bad days? And, you know, if I just would like to put that out in the world, that there are some simple things we can do and how we react to other people when we hear how they're suffering that may actually help them and support them and make their lives a little easier, and really focusing on their needs, the needs of the patients, the people who are suffering, is perhaps the best thing we can do rather than focusing on our own reaction.
And if I can piggyback on that, something I'd like to add is people that are going through any kind of difficult thing, whether it's the death of a loved one or a disease or anything like that, sometimes they don't know what they need. And so if you can just come up with an idea on your own and just say, like you mentioned this earlier, instead of saying, oh my God, I'm so sorry, just make an offer like, hey, would you like it if I brought some meals by next week for your family?
Oh, totally. That makes a huge difference. And I think especially when someone's experiencing trauma, they just need to have something offered to them. And yeah, you may get it wrong. You may offer the wrong thing, but at least you made an effort. And something simple like that of, oh, I'm sorry to hear you're having a hard time. Can I bring you dinner next week? Or can I pick up things at the grocery store for you? Some of those things make a big difference because they help people who are suffering really focus on their own healing or getting their life in order or whatever it is that they need to do.
And I'm personally not suffering anything, but if people out there want to come clean my house or wash my car,
you'll take it anyway, right?
I'll send my address and you swing by. Well, Andy, I just want to thank you so much, seriously, for sharing all this deeply personal stuff with the entire world. I know people are really grateful worldwide to have a voice that they can identify with, and it really means a great deal.
I'm so glad for the opportunity. You know, I've really learned through this experience that there's a lot of stigma around health and cancer in particular, and we all carry so much weight, you know, in dealing with these things in our personal lives. And I just have this feeling that if we could just relax a little bit and open it up and talk about it, a lot of the stress and the pain we feel, no matter what it is we're challenged with in our life, would be that much easier if we can just put it out in the open.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree. Well, Andy, how about we talk about some fun life stuff? What would be the title of your autobiography?
Take a Nap and Have a Snack. I'm one of those people who gets hangry. You know, it's like my kids are like, oh, Dad didn't have lunch again. He's in a bad mood.
By one of those people, I think you mean everyone walking the planet Earth, but go ahead.
Yeah, but I think I get it particularly bad. You know, in all seriousness, I think if I had the title an autobiography, if I ever wrote one, it would be something like that, just about making enough space in your life to appreciate the normal things that we all have to do. That is where the real art of living is for me.
Well, speaking of books, what was your favorite childhood book?
Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel. You ever read that one? I just
never heard of it.
Oh, there was this story about this this guy who had a steam shovel, you know, Mike Mulligan, and there was a need to kind of excavate like a new building. It was like a town hall or a school or something. And Mike Mulligan volunteers for the job, and he digs the hole and he does this big service to the community, and he gets to the bottom of the foundation, and the implication is like, oh, how do I get my steam shovel out of here? And so they end up building the building around the steam shovel, and it becomes the furnace for the building. And so then Mike Mulligan becomes like the furnace guy, the janitor guy, who's sitting in the basement. This is, you know, back in the 30s, like shoveling coal into the steam shovel to keep the building warm. And I just love that, like that idea that you can do something well, but you may still find yourself from circumstances where you need to pivot, and you can just get creative about looking at what you have and make something good of it and move on to the next thing.
Yeah, when fate shuts a door, come in through the window.
Yeah, there you go.
Also, can we just acknowledge that Mike Mulligan is a great name for a dude who, like, you want to hang out with and go to a bar with? Hey, Mike.
That's right.
Mike Mulligan, let's go to the bar. Are there any books that you wish everyone on the planet would read?
The one that I've gotten the most value about over the years is the Tao Te Ching. And, you know, it's just such simple, beautiful poetry. that has really profound things to say about life and how to live it. And that's one I think we could use a little bit more awareness of about in the world, and just try to encourage people to move through their days and weeks and years a little bit more fluidly and not get hung up on the small stuff.
Do you enjoy traveling?
I really do love traveling. Yeah.
And is there somewhere that you haven't traveled yet that you'd like to?
You know, this is going to sound weird, but like the place I've never traveled is that road that I really want to, is that road just down from the street from my house that I've never been down. Like, I could tell you I'd love to go to New Zealand or Iceland or Japan, and all that would be true. But I kind of feel like the biggest adventure is just in that next bend that I never haven't taken yet.
Well, I'm curious, how do you think your focus has changed now throughout your life from when you were a kid to 20s, 30s, 40s and dealing with everything you have?
Huh. Yeah, that's a good question. I turned 50 this year, and the thing that came to mind the most for me, and kind of just thinking about what that meant, was it was just a great time to kind of recalibrate my purpose and where I was getting meaning from in my life. And so far, I'm loving my 50th year. Like, I think just asking myself that question made it so much easier to let go of things that I've experienced as stressful or maybe was concerned about in my 40s. And that feels like a big step. Like, I still have to pay the mortgage. I still have to pay the bills. I still have to do that, all that. But just having a sense of like, yeah, it's going to be okay. I'll take care of it. And not letting myself get worked up around those things. It's been a big shift for me. But, you know, earlier, in my 20s and 30s, I really was driven by a strong desire to kind of accomplish things and make things happen. And I still have that, but I feel like more and more my emphasis is not just in doing things myself, but also trying to find a way to empower other people to realize their own dreams.
What do you do with your off hours? What are your hobbies? We already talked about being a bike shop owner.
Yeah. My family teases me about collecting hobbies. But there are a few things that have always kind of been interesting to me. I love camping. I love hiking. I love spending time outdoors. I'm interested in blacksmithing. I have a forge in my barn and love banging on metal. I don't get time to do it nearly as much as I would love to, but it is something that I really enjoy, and just that process of shaping metal and kind of trying to solve problems in three dimensions is really fascinating to me.
And I also happen to know, because we've known each other for a while, that you are a child of the 70s, 80s Dungeons and Dragons and Lego fan.
There you go. And it actually, when the pandemic hit, my kids who were 14 and 18, we went up to the attic, we busted out the Legos, and they sat on the folding table in the living room for about 3 months. And we just built the most epic city together. It was so fun. It was like a little bit every night, a few bricks here and there.
That's cool.
But yeah, those childhood pastimes are fun to revisit from time to time.
Well, Andy, it's 8 o'clock at night. You have the house to yourself and you're going to put some music on and dance like no one's watching. What song would you put on? What's your jam?
Oh man. I have pretty eclectic taste in music, and lately I've been listening to a lot of the Minutemen, an old early Southern California punk band, and so much more. I've also been into Lizzie Mercier Desclot, a French artist who passed away a number of years ago. And there's this really great African band I love called Bantu Continua Uhuru Consciousness. I think I got that right. BCUC, that just has the best grooves. I also play bass and just absolutely love the lines that this bass player lays down. They're totally inspiring and get me moving.
Andy, if you could sit down for 4 hours in an old timey pub with one person from all of human history, alive or dead, excluding your own family members or any religious prophets, who would you sit down with? What would you drink? And what's the first question you'd ask them?
Oh boy, that is a good question.
You can thank Jolene for that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Who would I want to sit down with? I think I would want to sit down with Robert Baden Powell, who's the founding of the scouting movement, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. And I, as a kid, I was an Eagle Scout, and as an adult, I've gotten my kids involved in an organization called the Baden-Powell Service Association, which is an inclusive co-ed back to basics outdoor scouting program.
Cool.
Really making an effort to be inclusive and equitable to people of all walks of life. And you know, Baden-Powell was historically a complicated figure. You know, he was a military guy. He killed people. He was a racist. He was a misogynist, very much of his era, being like a kind of white English guy, a colonist. And yet at the same time, he at the core was also a multiculturalist. He was someone who believed in the power of youth. He was someone who had progressive ideas for how we could all be making the world a better place. And I just find him to be such a complicated figure historically, and someone who's also, you know, had a big bearing on my childhood. You know, I learned about his life as an adult that I would love to just sit down and talk with him, get in arguments, dream of things we could do together.
Well, okay. So let's go back to the bar for a minute.
Yeah.
What would you drink? And what's the first question you'd ask him?
Well, you know, I think I would want to meet on a sunny early afternoon, and I'd want a black tea, on a foggy, like English countryside or something like that. It feels like it would spit. And, you know, what would I ask him? I think I would ask him the question, like, honestly, jump forward over 100 years, you know, Sir Robert Baden-Powell, and, you know, what do you think about transgender kids joining Scouts? You know, what do you think about, you know, basically all of the kind of changes and progressive changes in society we've seen, and really just try to engage him around the issue of what is human development and what is service, and try to get to the bottom of like how he would relate his early 1900 values, which were liberal at the time, and how they might translate to today's world. I would just find that to be a fascinating discussion.
I agree. And it's also fascinating to think about if back then he was considered a liberal, and then today he would not be considered a liberal, then today, if you and I are considered liberals, are we not? What's the world going to be like in 500 years?
Totally. You know,
it's crazy to think about.
I get in fights with some of my progressive minded friends sometimes around this, because they think they got it. Like, they got it nailed. I'm like, no, you really don't. Like, give it another 50 years and your grandkids are going to be rolling their eyes at you about things you can't even comprehend yet, you know, and that, yeah, that's human exactly. nature. And that's the beauty of seeing how society changes. And yeah, it's the real remarkable individuals who can find time to age and not let their ideas calcify, but stay flexible at the times.
Andy, if you could travel in time, where would you go and why?
I would love to go back kind of pre-European contact with North America. And I would love, as an environmentalist, I would just love to see what the landscape looked like. I read this book a number of years ago called 1491. That was kind of a journalistic take on
It's a great book.
Academic
and 1492
literature.
And 1493, and
and just kind of imagining what that pre-contact. Well, it's based in science, right? What we knew know that time was like, but I would just love to see it. Like, you know, take Manhattan Island, you know, New York City, and you know, that place has been altered so much by development. You know, what was it like? I mean, there were oyster reefs in New York Harbor, you know, billions and billions of oysters that, you know, provided food that people subsisted on. Just this,
and you're talking about 1491, the book by Charles Mann?
That's right. That's right. So just to be able to experience what the landscape was like, how the people interacted with the landscape. And I guess for that matter, I would just love to see really any pre-industrial corner of the world, and you know how it was, and you know how people lived in it.
What's your guilty TV pleasure?
Boy, right now it's American Gods, which I just have to see, by Neil Gaiman. I read the book when it came out. I just love his work, and have since he wrote the Sandman series. I think it's brilliant. Like, everything is just so brilliant and so fun to explore.
What quality do you most admire in human beings?
You know, I think the single biggest thing that makes humanity have such great potential, but also makes us the greatest risk to ourselves, which I admire on both fronts, is our ability to adapt. Mm-hmm. And adaptability is the ability to apply ourselves to different situations and environments is an amazing trait that, you know, maybe other species have it and I just can't see it, but it seems to be really something that, you know, sets the human race apart.
Are you afraid of dying?
No, I mean, we all have our time and that's going to come. Are there things I'd like to do before that time comes? Yeah. Absolutely. Am I looking forward to the potential of having a painful death? No one likes that. But, but you know, it's something I remember from an early age, like lying in bed at night thinking just, this is going to happen sometime and just feeling okay with that. And, you know, you never know until you're there, I guess. But
well, what would be your biggest disappointment if you died tomorrow?
I think just, maybe there's people out there that I would like to have one last conversation with or just really be present with. It's like we move through life and things get so busy, right? And sometimes we all get in our little tracks and we forget that there's other people standing in front of us. And, you know, in every day and in every interaction, sometimes those moments pass us by. And I think I would probably on my deathbed look back and say, that person I saw in the checkout line 15 minutes ago, I wish I gave him a smile, you know? So it's a good reminder to really try to live each moment for itself and just be present with people and not get caught up with where we want to be.
What do you hope people say about you at your funeral?
You know, I would hope people would say nice things to me about me. I'd hope they'd say that I had a positive impact in the world. And I hope they would say that I inspired them in some way. I remember being a kid in Sunday school years ago and reading one of these like cheap little pamphlets that your Sunday school teacher hands you when they need all the kids to sit tight and not make noise. And it had some like parable in it about somebody who they went to heaven because they did good things in the world and didn't know about it. Like that, I'm not a religious person, but that kind of idea always stuck with me. That go through your life having a positive benefit without kind of worrying about whether a positive benefit that feel.
If heaven exists and assuming you arrive, what would you like to hear God say the moment you meet?
Welcome home.
Okay. Andy, what superpower would you choose?
You know, I love this question. And my answer is that I wish that I could maintain homeostasis in any environment.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. Like I would love to be able to walk out in like my briefs in a snowstorm and go cross country skiing and just be like, I'm fine, you know? And I would love it to be like, I'd love to be on a safari in the rainforest and have it be 110 degrees and humid out and just be like, I'm fine.
Or breathe underwater.
Exactly. So just like this idea of like, yeah, you could just go do pretty much anything within the laws of physics and just not be uncomfortable would be really cool. Like maybe you would put on a light sweater and then everything else would just take care of itself. So I'm not looking to fly. I just want to have ease in moving through life.
If you could tell your younger self anything, what would it be?
I would try to tell myself to relax. I'd try to tell myself not to stress out and try to tell myself to, you know, love my inner light a little bit more. You know, it's my experience growing up, like I had a great childhood, but, you know, we all have those moments where things just feel like they're getting piled on. And, you know, as you grow older and you look back, you're like, yeah, it didn't matter that much. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just wish that is a perspective that I could have had at some difficult moments in my life.
Andy, what do you think is the purpose of art?
The purpose of art is to allow people to create. And it's not the product that matters. It's the act of creation, you know, which is the weird thing about art, because like I could sit down and I could write a song right now and I could have this experience that kind of informed that song on my guitar or my bass. But then that song becomes kind of a fixed thing and it gets recorded and it gets put up on SoundCloud or whatever. And other people relate to it as a fixed thing. And yeah, that's the catch is like, how can you create something that lets that spark of creation, that moment of interaction really be true to itself and not get fixed at a moment in time. So I think when we do have things that are fixed, their purpose is to inspire, and the best art will inspire other people to create themselves. And you know, maybe it's not creating through any of the formal arts. Maybe it's just something they do or the spirit that they carry themselves with. You know, that's creation as well. And if art can accomplish that, then it's done its job.
What's next for you?
Dinner.
Andy, the last thing we do on the show, as you may know, is a little game I have called 299 Philosophical and Life Questions with Moonbird. I have my list here of 299 philosophical and life questions I've collected from friends, family, and the internet. You get to pick two numbers, and I will read you those questions. What are your two numbers?
4 and 27.
4 and 27. Okay. Number 4, what's your favorite fast food restaurant menu item?
Ooh, that's a good one. Favorite, this is a philosophical question. Whose list are you working
it's
off?
It's philosophical of? And philosophical and life question.
What show am I on? This is ridiculous. My favorite fast food takeout item. You know, I think that's going to be a scoop of chocolate almond ice cream from Boyce's Dairy Bar, downtown Kingston, New York.
I am not going to accept that answer. I think you have to choose from the general category of fast food, okay, which is like McDonald's, Taco Bell, Fatburger, all the, you know, the okay, actual, the bad okay, for you fast foods.
Good. Falafel sandwich.
From where?
From Abba's Falafel in Rhinebeck, New York.
Is that fast food?
Yeah. It's fast as it gets for falafel.
Number 27, what kind of parent do you think you are?
Boy, that's a good question. I should pull my kids in the room and have them just answer that question directly for you. What kind of parent do I think I am? Well, I think I'm fair. I think I have high expectations for principals and the way that they conduct their lives, but also feel that I'm flexible and letting them make their own choices and be the people who they want to be. I'd like to think that my kids think that I'm supportive and engaged, but also, you know, kind of also respect their privacy and let them explore all the things that life offers them.
50 years from now, when you're gone and your children are a little older than you and they listen back to this episode, probably in some weird virtual reality environment, what would you like to say to them in the future?
Just say, be kind to yourself, you know, work hard, engage in life seriously, but don't take it too seriously. If I haven't told them everything else they need to know by then I'm not a good parent.
Andy Bicking, thank you so much for being here today and for sharing so many wonderful things about your life and your family. Really appreciate it. And of course, I sincerely wish you the best of luck saving our planet. And we hope to see you again.
Thanks so much, Daniel. This was loads of fun. I really appreciate it.
Friends and listeners, if you'd like more information about Scenic Hudson, you can visit them online at scenichudson.org or on social media at Scenic Hudson. If you'd like more information about helping out with the environment, there's some nice links for you in the show notes. And as always, if you'd like even more Moonbird in your life, and hey, who wouldn't? Head on over to memoriesofamoonbird.com or visit me on social media at memoriesofamoonbird. Stay safe.